our headlines. The Taliban moved closer to the Afghan capital, Kabul, after they captured the strategic city of Ghazni, the 10th provincial capital they have overrun in just a week. The Lebanese prime minister calls an emergency cabinet meeting on the central bank's decision to cut fuel subsidies amid the country's financial crisis. Also, Japan asks hundreds of thousands of its residents in southwest of the country to evacuate amid fears of landslides caused by torrential rain. Hello and welcome to your world news coming to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story, the Afghan government has offered a share in power to the Taliban in return for an end to fighting in the country. Afghan government sources said Kabul's negotiating team has submitted a power-sharing proposal to Qatar as mediator. In the latest developments on the ground, the Taliban took control of the police headquarters in the western city of Herat. This comes after they captured the strategic city of Ghazni, the 10th Afghan provincial capital to fall to the militants in just a week. That's apart from dozens of villages and towns as well as border crossings that the group has seized recently. The conflict in Afghanistan has escalated dramatically since May, with the Taliban now estimated to be in control of nearly two-thirds of the country. Lebanon's caretaker prime minister has called an emergency cabinet meeting to discuss a move by the country's central bank to end subsidies on fuel imports. In a tweet, Hassan Diab's office said the decision contravenes law. Earlier, President Michel Aoun summoned Central Bank Governor Riaz Salama over the issue. Aoun's party also called the bank's move a sudden and unilateral, saying it disregarded a government decision for a gradual lifting of subsidies. The party chief also called the decision, quote, a new coup, and asked his party and people to prepare to mobilize. The central bank has said it would offer credit lines for fuel imports based on the market price for the Lebanese pound from Thursday. The move would effectively end the fuel subsidy that has drained the bank's reserves since the country descended into financial crisis in 2019. Political analyst Ali Hamia says the unilateral decision of Lebanon's central bank to end fuel subsidies demonstrates the country's much deeper problem of currency shortage.
The problem is the central bank governor took this decision unilaterally, and illegal decision according to the caretaker prime minister. He said it's illegal and without asking or having an argument, not even an agreement with anybody. He just took the decision. There is something like we call it in fishy in the situation. We are between either declaration, starting a declaration of a state bankruptcy, or people in the state declare a declaration of starvation. We are either state starvation or state bankruptcy. And this all goes back to the quicksand pressure coming from outside countries such as United States, Israel, and some Arab countries.
The Palestinian president strongly condemns Israelis' plans to build over 2,000 new settler units in the occupied West Bank. President Mahmoud Abbas's office rejected the move, saying it contradicted the U.S. position President Joe Biden expressed in a call with his Palestinian counterpart. The regime's new plans come despite international criticism against its settlement expansions. In July, a U.N. human rights investigator said Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank amount to a war crime. More than 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 occupation of the West Bank. All Israeli settlements are deemed illegal under international law. Iran's foreign ministry calls in the British and Russian envoys over a controversial joint photo that has caused public outcry among Iranians. The ministry slammed the photograph as unacceptable, saying that the people of Iran have always rejected and stood against arrogant thoughts and moves. The Russian and British ambassadors both expressed regret over the, quote, misunderstanding caused by the picture, saying they meant no offense. The photo released by the Russian embassy on Wednesday showed a meeting between the two diplomats. The scene resembled a World War II-era conference in Tehran between the Soviet, U.S., and British leaders 2 years after the Anglo-Soviet invasion of Iran. The photo drew criticism from Iranian netizens and officials as the conference is reminiscent of the violation of the country's sovereignty. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has provided Parliament with a list of his proposed cabinet members. The nominees will need a vote of confidence by lawmakers before they take office as ministers, Yusuf Jalali reports.
Ebrahim Raisi handed to Parliament a list of his proposed cabinet ministers on Wednesday, a week after he took the oath of office as Iran's new president. Legislators now have 1 week to review the credentials of Raisi's picks before an open vote of confidence session is held with the presence of the president himself to defend his nominees.
For 1 week, 13 parliament commissions will be working 3 shifts a day, where they will be host the proposed ministers, asking them about their plans and visions. 3 days after the 1 week time frame is over, open sessions will be held in parliament, where the proposed ministers will take the podium one by one to lay out their plans and take questions from lawmakers.
The list consists of 19 nominees for 19 ministerial posts. Among the proposed names are Hossein Amir Abdullahian as the new foreign minister, Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani as the defense minister, and Ismail Khatib as the intelligence minister. Lawmakers seem to not have issues with the proposed list and have promised to be cooperative with the new administration.
There will definitely be synergy and convergence between parliament and the government. We need to work together to solve the country's economic problems. We are determined to remove the illegal sanction imposed on the nation, so lawmakers and the new administration must join hands to achieve this goal.
Ebrahim Raisi won the June 18th election by landslide, securing 64% of the vote. He was sworn in on August 4th, 2 days after he was officially endorsed by Iran's leader. Raisi had 2 weeks to introduce his proposed cabinet lineup, but he released the list a week ahead of the deadline. Parliament says it will be swift to review the nominated ministers in order to speed up the formation of the new cabinet.
If all goes as planned, open floor vote of confidence sessions will be held after the week-long deliberations over the credentials of the proposed ministers will conclude behind closed doors. Given the close ties between the Iranian parliament and the new government, lawmakers expect that the vote of confidence process will wrap up in a matter of 3 work shifts. Yusuf Jalali from the Iranian parliament in Tehran.
Japan issues warnings of extremely heavy rains for several parts of its southwest regions, prompting evacuations notices. Japan's meteorological agency reported a heavy storm system moving in, bringing along torrential rains. Authorities issued a level 5 alert in areas of Kyushu Island, warning residents to take immediate action to protect themselves. Hundreds of thousands of residents in Nagasaki and other parts of Kyushu Island have been asked to evacuate. Local officials say there is high risk of dangerous floods and landslides. This comes as the country has seen more than average rainfall levels for the month of August in the past 2 days. Meanwhile, over 100,000 hectares of forest and farmland in Greece have burned over the past 2 weeks in the worst wave of wildfires since 2007. The European Forest Fire Information System released the data on Thursday. Greece is facing several hundred wildfires fueled by an extraordinary heat wave that struck at the beginning of August. The flames have ravaged several regions across the country and prompted mass evacuations. Earlier, Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis described the fires as a natural disaster of exceptional magnitude. Neighboring Turkey has also been battling devastating blazes for nearly 2 weeks. Australia's capital, Canberra, has entered a snap lockdown after the city confirmed its first COVID-19 case in more than a year.
The ACT will enter into a 7-day lockdown from 5 p.m. tonight. This decision is as the result of a positive COVID-19 case in the territory, a case that has been infectious in the community. We also have positive wastewater detections around the ACT.
About 400,000 people have been placed under a stay-at-home order for a week. Residents will only be allowed to leave home for essential reasons. The announcement prompted panic buying in the city, with residents, many without masks, rushing to supermarkets to stock up essentials ahead of the lockdown. This is the first lockdown on the nation's political hub in months. Authorities say the situation is a serious public health risk.
We do not currently know the source of the infection, but extensive investigation has been underway for many hours. This is the most serious public health risk that we have faced in the Territory this year, and really since the beginning of the pandemic.
Millions of people are already under lockdowns in Australia's southeast, including the largest cities, Sydney and Melbourne. That followed the recent surge in infections, largely blamed on the highly infectious Delta variant. Authorities seek to tighten the restrictions in Sydney further as daily infections continue to hover near record highs there. They say extra military personnel may be called in to ensure that people observe that rules or the rules. Nearly 600 Army personnel are already deployed in the city despite simmering public anger over the tightened restrictions. The country has so far recorded over 37,500 COVID cases and 946 related deaths. Russia has set a single-day record for the COVID-19 deaths, confirming 808 new fatalities for the past day. This is the first time the country has crossed the 800 mark for daily virus deaths. Russia's anti-coronavirus crisis center also put the country's new infections at nearly 22,000. Russia is the fourth worst-hit country in the world in terms of infections, with over 6.5 million total cases. The country's total death toll from the virus also stands at over 168,000. Russia has been in the grip of the third wave of the pandemic since mid-June. The recent outbreak is blamed on the Delta variant and people's reluctance to get vaccinated. Russia was the first country to authorize a coronavirus vaccine, but so far nearly 20% of the country's population has been fully inoculated. With the emergence of the novel coronavirus in late 2019 in China, life was upended for billions of people worldwide. The virus, which soon caused a pandemic, has exacted a heavy cost on economies and inflicted a heavy loss of life. The invention of vaccines became a beacon of hope to many around the world. But nearly a year after the first COVID-19 jabs were administered, the pandemic still rages on and fear distribution remains a distant goal. We have a report.
All the figures point to one fact. COVID-19 vaccine distribution is not fair. To date, over 4.5 billion jabs have been administered worldwide, according to data from the University of Oxford. Wealthy countries have consumed the lion's share of vaccines, with more than 4 out of 5 doses given to people living in high and upper middle income countries. Low-income nations have administered less than 0.5% of shots. To further illustrate the wide divide, we can look at the statistics of the United States. The country has administered over 350 million doses. That translates to 106 doses per 100 American. In Africa, that number is around 6 per 100 people. To make matters worse, as some countries have not been able to even kick off their vaccination campaigns, rich nations are considering giving additional jabs to people already fully inoculated. Germany, France, Russia, and the UAE have already started offering booster shots, while the US and the UK have announced or hinted at plans to do so in the near future. This has caused much outrage among activists. Most recently, a group of campaigners slammed Britain for ordering millions of booster jabs, saying the UK is effectively pushing poor countries to the back of the vaccine queue. The World Health Organization has called for a halt on boosters through at least by the end of September. The UN health body urge rich nations to give shots to the poorer countries that are struggling to inoculate even their highly vulnerable populations. But the US almost immediately rejected the plea, saying it has already donated more doses than any other country. That does not seem to have convinced the WHO. On Tuesday, the organization again slammed the existing divides in COVID-19 vaccine distributions as disgraceful and called for a more equitable approach. It said the power to overturn the imbalance lies in the hands of only 20 leaders around the world. The World Health Organization says it wants every country to have vaccinated at least 10% of its population by the end of September. But with the current pace of vaccination drive in the world's underprivileged nations, that goal might be too hard to achieve.
Beijing calls on Washington to abide by the One China policy and to refrain from sending any wrong signal to the Taiwan Independence Forces. The Chinese Foreign Ministry made the call in reaction to the U.S. Senate passing a pro-Taiwan bill. It directs the U.S. Secretary of State to develop a strategy to regain observer status for Taiwan and the World Health Organization. The ministry's spokesperson slammed the move as a total political manipulation by a handful of anti-China politicians. Hua Chunyang said the bill gravely violates the One China principle and the joint communiques between the two countries. Hua also denounced the move as a breach of international law, a gross interference in China's internal affairs. North Korea has slammed the U.S. and South Korea for going ahead with military exercises, saying they will counter such aggression with their own, quote, substantial deterrent. Frank Smith reports from the South Capital, Seoul.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, has blasted the decision to hold joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises in South Korea this month. Her statement, read on official media, also called for the removal of U.S. troops and weapons from the Korean Peninsula.
The U.S. is determinedly pushing forward with these aggressive war drills when international attention is focused on the development of the situation on the Korean Peninsula. It is indeed the chief architect destroying peace and stability in the region. And this also proves that diplomatic engagement and dialogue with no strings attached touted by the present U.S. administration is hypocrisy to cover up its aggressive nature.
The U.S. administration of President Joe Biden has reached out for, quote, unconditional talks with Pyongyang. Although U.S.-led United Nations Security Council sanctions over North Korea's nuclear weapons program remain in place, experts consider North Korea's perspective.
The most important thing is the content of the joint exercises. Officially, they are described as defensive in nature, but if you look closely, they employ very offensive strategies, preemptively striking North Korea, removing state leadership, and capturing North Korean territory. It's threatening from the North Korean standpoint.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in had been trying to generate peace with North Korea, but Seoul's close alliance with Washington and purchase of major U.S. weapons has hindered his efforts toward Pyongyang. The decision to go ahead with the joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises has already impacted inter-Korean relations. In late July, hotline communications between the two Koreas were restored after being severed for more than a year. However, since the announcement of the drills, North Korea is no longer answering South Korea's calls. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. Please accept our condolences on the arrival of the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Panahian. Please stay tuned. The most successful part of the mission of Prophet Muhammad is for sure the very personality of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. Also, the part of human fitrah which has flourished the most is Imam al-Husayn. If you desire the truth, but you are not burnt inside, the light hasn't entered your heart. If human fitrah flourishes, it will flare up. If human fitrah flourishes, nothing will remain of the material part of a person. Thus, the only way to experience the flourished fitrah inside ourselves is Imam al-Husayn.
Karbala! As I step onto your sands, you capture my eyes. Karbala, I see heaven has been placed beneath your skies.
یا آقا یه چیزی رو زیاد حرفشو بزنی از چشم آدم میفته، زیاد تکرار بشه از چشم آدم میفته.
Some say if you talk about something too much, it becomes unimportant. As we have in the famous proverb, friendship is a stronger at a distance. So, why doesn't Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam become unimportant to me, no matter how much I say his name? Why? Remember Imam al-Husayn constantly for a while and see if he becomes unimportant to you. I will see you after 40 days. Where will you be? You will fly in the skies. Your only fault is that you don't repeat the name of Imam al-Husayn very much.
Karbala, why do you hold such memories? Ashura.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Panahian. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care, and Assalamu alaik, Ya Aba Abdullah al-Husayn.
I'm beginning, the season's tears are flowing. Our iman, we are condoling. Our new year starts with morning. Muharram is a beginning, the season's tears are flowing. Our iman, we are condoling. Karbala, what precious blood was spilled there? Ashura, Al Hussein was murdered here. Ashura.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. Doc Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Dispossession, the great social housing swindle directed by Paul Sung. And joining me in this episode are Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian, The Telegraph, and many other outlets. And beside him is Claudia Webb, who is a Labour Party councillor in the London Borough of Islington. Now, Dispossession is a documentary that explores the catastrophic failures by successive governments that have led to a chronic shortage of social housing in Britain. The film focuses on the neglect, demolition, and regeneration of council estates across the UK and investigates how the state works with the private sector to demolish council estates to build the land they stand on, making properties that are unaffordable to the majority of people.
They're going to regenerate it, which means total demolition. And when it very first started, it was a case of nothing will happen without your approval. Well, that was lie number one on day one, and it's never changed.
We've got councils of all kinds across London who are trying to demolish traditional council estates. They're actually destroying communities.
It was Mrs. Thatcher whose right to buy scheme was a vote winner for families like the Pattersons. She gave them the title deeds to their council house. They gave her tea in return.
Don't you think this is lovely?
The right to buy was probably the most popular policy ever introduced by Conservative government.
Housing is a fundamental human need, and it's one the market just doesn't seem to be capable of providing.
We should be building every year about 240,000 to 250,000 homes, and we're nowhere near that.
I want there to be no hope areas in the new Britain that we want to create.
Essentially, we've had successive governments that simply haven't seen the role for social housing, and they've been cutting it.
It's not seen as being aspirational, and aspiration is the key word.
For the last 10, 20 years, housing stock that used to be here is down, it's gone.
Access to housing in Glasgow, to social housing, is nigh on impossible.
Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary tackles a very serious problem facing this country, and it was a very moving and deeply personal documentary for the director, I believe, as he grew up on a council estate. And especially in the wake of the Grenfell Tower tragedy, this film comes at a very important time. Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
I was very impressed by it. I thought the first time I saw this film, I was a little bit concerned about how compacted it was, the amount of information it crams into an hour and I think 26 minutes. The second time I saw it, I was impressed by the amount of information that it did get in, the amount of ground that it covers, the fact that it covers all these issues from so many different angles. I mean, you're getting the input of the politicians who have to make the policy decisions that cause estates to be built or to be knocked down. You're also getting the input from people on the ground, residents of the estates, who have a very different take on it. So I'm a big fan of this film.
So as you say, this documentary, it was very dense, packed with information, statistics, and usually these films are quite difficult to watch. So do you think the director was successful in conveying his message there?
Yes, because in part I think that it makes its points pictorially. I mean, it is very crisply shot, and it's one of those situations where I think if we're walking down a street anywhere, this is the kind of issue that hits you smack in the face. You know, we could go for a walk around the studios here and we would see 3, 4, 5 luxury flat developments, springing up everywhere, but we'd probably see more homeless people than we'd see social housing developments going up. And the film is very acutely attuned to what is actually happening at street level, and it shows you the disrepair that many estates have fallen into, and it contrasts that with the slightly sort of eerie gloom of these new developments going up that don't seem to be inhabited by anyone because no one's got the money to afford to move in there.
And Claudia, if I could turn to you now, as someone who works closely with this issue, is the social housing crisis in this country as bad as the documentary suggests it is?
Well, the documentary highlights quite well, actually, the state of play of council housing and council house in the UK, and in particular, actually, in London. And the sort of the dilemma that councils face as against the sort of the notion of community, the notion of identity, and the notion of neighbourhood, the concept of fairness right at the very heart of an urban inner city area. and what does a home mean? And it begins to explore what that means today as against what it should have meant. And what we've got really in terms of what the documentary is portraying and what the film is portraying is this whole issue of, you know, council homes being sold off for profit, council land being sold off for profit, and exposing really a reality and dichotomy of huge waiting lists, homelessness, and yet council homes being sold in off the profit against that sort of waiting list, and then what happens to communities and what happens to neighbourhoods. It's a stark contrast, and the film has really brought home and brought out the realities of the dangers of making the wrong decisions.
Indeed, and this documentary, one of the key messages is that a home is a right and not a privilege.
We need to offer housing to people at lower rates than full market cost. And the way historically we've done that is we've built social housing. We've provided housing to people that the state has some direct investment in, on the premise that not everybody can afford to rent at full market cost, or indeed afford to purchase their own home.
The current government has slashed investment in social housing so much that the housing crisis can only get worse. The only solution is to invest in social housing again, both through local authorities to build council homes and through housing associations to build social homes, in the way that the post-war government invested. And they need to be homes that people can afford, not homes that are called affordable, which are not.
If you build a council estate and people move in, those people pay rent to the local authority. After a few years, then the cost of building has paid for itself. Whereas if you have private rent, A, it's a lot more expensive, B, that money goes straight into landlords' pockets and doesn't get reinvested. It's a really good economic model, and it also points to the fact that housing should be a right for everybody.
In this documentary, we learn there's various misconceptions about social housing. Claudia, if I could ask you, why is there a need for social housing?
Well, social housing is really relevant in a local area where people, in a sense, can't afford to live in a home unless housing is provided that meets their ability to pay for that home. And in a sense, what we've got is a growing population and basic need. And a basic need is a roof over your head. And if councils are deprived from building homes, then in a sense what you've got is demand outstripping supply. And really what the documentary highlighted by showing clips of Margaret Thatcher, it highlights Thatcherism and the policies of Thatcherism, which at the time was
the right to buy scheme,
which was one, the issue about right to buy, but two, under Thatcherism they stopped councils from building council homes. Councils used to be a machine for council homes. So within local authorities, you not only saw the production of homes, but you also saw the architects, the builders, the quantity surveyors, all of the professional skill sets located within a council. Those skill sets have long gone.
And thank you for that point and shedding light on the need for social housing. And Mike, if I can turn to you now, we learned from the film that there are various stigmatisms about social housing. What are they? So what are some of these stigmatisms?
Well, one of the issues that the film addresses very well is the recent rise of TV shows like Benefit Street and things like that, where people who live on housing estates are, you know, these places are called sink estates, and you know, there's a certain stigma that goes with that. But there's a portrayal of people who live on estates as feckless and, you know, alcoholic, and you know, someone who's
scrounging.
Exactly, that's the kind of show. And these shows are very cheap to produce, like all reality TV, very cheap to produce, can get syndicated and make a TV channel or production company lots of money. What they actually give back to a society, a country, a community, very little. It's, you know, to stigmatize the people who appear on these shows and people who live on council estates in general. And I think part of that is that because these shows are made by people from outside those communities looking in, And it's often, as the film suggests, people who actually live on council estates, they have a community, they have a life there, they know where they're going, they know, you know, where their house relates to other people, the people who live next door to them. And it's not a sink estate. It's they're not circling the plug hole. You know, they're getting by. These places are functional, but they're being depicted in such a way as to suggest that they're not, and that they need knocking down.
We're going to continue this discussion in the next part.
I want there to be no hope areas in the new Britain that we want to create.
In his first public speech following Labour's landslide victory in 1997's general election, Tony Blair stood on the Aylesbury estate in southeast London and vowed there would be no forgotten people in the Britain his party wanted to build. 20 years later, residents of the Aylesbury might wonder what happened to New Labour's bold vision of the future. Since 2001, campaigners have fought against Southwark Council's plans to regenerate the estate. The council argued that the Aylesbury needs to be demolished due to the high cost of essential repairs. Campaigners claim that the council allowed the estate to deteriorate in order to facilitate its demise and justify a £1.5 billion redevelopment project.
So we saw Tony Blair there. And Claudia, I have to ask you, why didn't Blair fulfil his promises?
Well, I mean, I think the reality is that when in 1997 Labour came into power in the aftermath of Thatcherism, in the aftermath of councils not being invested in to build council housing, and you know, one could have wished and hoped that the new policy of Labour would have been to enable councils to build council homes again. A good council will build good quality homes, and with the resources and the investment we'll invest in the stock that it has. But equally, if designs aren't right, and you know, designs for their time aren't always fit for the future, and you then need to think about how do you make that housing stock work, how do you make it livable and continue to be enjoyable. But equally, what's important is, and what I fundamentally believe in, is if you are going to regenerate an estate, then what you need to bring back is council housing. You regenerate the estate to create continued council homes, and that we shouldn't need to, as councils, go into business with the private sector and sell off the land and sell off the homes for profit. And that's what councils need investment. So they don't have to do that. Maybe that they weren't presented with was the investment that was necessary to rebuild council homes rather than engaging in a partnership with the private sector.
So you're saying that the Labour Party, the New Labour back then, effectively inherited this crisis. But Mike, from the documentary I get the sense that the Conservative Party are much to blame, but do Labour share as much blame also?
Well, one of the strengths of the film is that it recognises that this is essentially a non-partisan issue. You know, everyone, whether you're of the right or of the left, needs a roof above your head. And I think it recognises, as much as, you know, Labour and the Conservatives like to play this fun game on Question Time of blaming one another for previous policies, there is a degree to which both parties are to blame, and this is why we're in the situation that we're in now. But yes, that right to buy scheme was, although a huge success at the time, has proven to have taken so many properties out of the public sphere and put them in private hands. But I think at the same time, the film says that, you know, when Tony Blair did come into power, not enough was done to counteract that policy. It was seen as such a sort of overwhelming success. What can you do? You know, well, you could build more houses, and I think that was one of the issues that leads to the situation that we're in right now, that we simply don't have enough houses for the people who need them.
And another, I want to talk about a different aspect of the documentary now. And one of the effects of the housing crisis seems to be the dismantling of the sense of community. I get this sense from the documentary that the film suggests that there were outside parties that were directly targeting and sort of dividing the community in order to conquer it. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is, in some ways, what the film is talking about is the direction of the entire nation over the past 50 years. I mean, we're told very early on that a lot of social housing was built close to factories, close to industries. And of course, once those industries closed down in the 60s, 70s, 80s, the last decade or so, where do the people who live on those estates go now? You know, how do they pay their rent? And if they can't pay their rents, does someone come in and take their property away from them? And so that it's raising bigger questions than just questions around housing. It's about, you know, who, you know, how much responsibility do councils have for the people who live in within their remit?
Well, we'll just have to pause there again just for now. I'll let you get back to that point, Claudia.
As the estate falls into decay, I believe it was a deliberate strategy of the local authority because they saw the Elephant Castle at the time as a prime market for real estate.
I haven't got all the details on the Haygate, but my understanding is that some of the social rental properties will be built in another part of the borough. But again, it's around the fact that if we are going to take down a certain number of social rented properties, it's about making sure we're re-providing that, actually re-providing more for the same level of rent.
For the demolition of 9,000 plus council homes and their replacement with luxury apartments costing £600,000 and £700,000 as an entry price, was their answer to the problem? That's no answer to the 9,000, 10,000 tenants that were living in secure accommodation at the time that are now dispersed across London and many dispersed outside of London.
People who benefit from the housing crisis are, of course, property developers. They want to have the densest housing possible. And the best way to make dense housing is to build luxury apartments and to make it look like, you know, you're building a tall tower block, not to house many families as they did in the 60s and 70s, but to give a really slick community lifestyle.
Now, before we went to that clip, we were just talking about the notion of dismantling of the community by the outside parties. Claudia, did you agree with what Mike said?
Well, I mean, I have a different take on it because obviously we're in, my context is London, and I can see that in areas like Newark, in Nuneaton, for example, which had a coal industry, that if you create homes around a particular industry and then that industry disappears in terms of the mining industry, then you are left with homes and people without access to meaningful work. That's not the case in London. What you've got in London is a total land grab. It's a disgrace, really, in terms of a total land grab by big developers who are basically capitalising on the opportunity that is presented by the lack of inability of councils to build and invest in homes. The policy of not allowing councils to build homes, that is what's been problematic because it's been over decades and not over a few years. What we have now in places like my own borough, where we have a good council that is building good quality homes, we bucked the trend and we sought to build council homes. And we sought to find ways to do that and ensure that we do not sell off council land. But where we have planning, where we give planning permissions to the developers where they've got their own private land, what unfortunately has been created historically over time is the notion of poor. We have a policy of 50% of that must be affordable. Affordable meaning, you know, social rent properties. And what they do is they build that integral to the development, but they build it on the side or at the back, and that's where the creation of poor doors happens.
Of course,
it's
you're in Jeremy Corbyn's borough, and he pledged to end the housing crisis. But I want to talk about this notion now in the film of social cleansing, which seems to be a contentious, controversial term, which means that low-income workers are being driven out of the capital, London, because of the soaring rents and the interests of corporations, of course, and real estate agents. What do we learn in the film about this?
The film's very good on gentrification and how neighbourhoods have changed rapidly over the last 10, 15, 20 years. So, you know, social housing is of less concern than attracting middle-class renters with lots of disposable income who can afford coffee and hummus and all the treats of living in the inner cities. But you know, the there is a degree to which housing policy seems to have been skewed specifically, almost exclusively towards that particular demographic. And of course that, you know, drives out people who are originally living there, and you know, that's one of the many big issues that this film addressed.
Well, part of that was, you know, the huge banking crisis that happened. You know, what happened after the banking crisis was in London, then the London's property market was then used as the place where people invest. And so what you've got is overseas investors purchasing land and property, never ever living in those properties, and creating a this and them scenarios and situations. What is a disgrace is when it's set against that. So you've already got that as a problem going on. Set against that is when councils have got land and homes in council control. What is a disgrace is councils then selling that off in some kind of partnership with the private sector.
It is such a complex issue.
It is.
Unfortunately, we're running out of time in this programme. And just final 30 seconds to Mike. Would you recommend this documentary?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're now in a situation where the Evening Standard can run a front page about house prices going up as though that's some great triumph. To me, it looks more and more like a tragedy, and this film absolutely reflects that.
Well, thank you very much for your time and joining the show. And I'm afraid that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.